The reading this morning is taken from the book of Nehemiah, chapter 5. Now the men and their wives raised a great outcry against their fellow Jews. Some were saying, "We and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain." Others were saying, "We are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our homes to get grain during the famine." Still others were saying, "We've had to borrow money to pay the king's taxes on our fields and vineyards. Although we are the same flesh and blood as our fellow Jews, and though our children are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. Some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but we are powerless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others." When I heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry. I pondered them in my mind and then accused the nobles and officials. I told them, "You're charging your own people interest." So I called together a large meeting to deal with them and said, "As far as possible, we have bought back our fellow Jews who were sold to the Gentiles. Now you are selling your own people only for them to be sold back to us." They kept quiet because they could find nothing to say. So I continued, "What you're doing isn't right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God to avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies? I and my brothers and my men are also lending the people money and grain. But let us stop charging interest. Give back to them immediately their fields, vineyards, olive groves and houses, and also the interest you're charging them, 1% of the money, grain, new wine and olive oil." "We will give it back," they said, "and we will not demand anything more from them. We will do as you say." Then I summoned the priests and made the nobles and officials take an oath to do what they had promised. I also shook out the folds of my robe and said, "In this way, may God shake out of their house and possessions anyone who does not keep this promise. So may such a person be shaken out and emptied." At this, the whole assembly said, "Amen," and praised the Lord. And the people did as they had promised. Moreover, from the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, until his 32nd year, 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the food allotted to the governor. But the earlier governors, those preceding me, placed a heavy burden on the people and took 40 shekels of silver from them, in addition to food and wine. Their assistants also lorded it over the people. But out of reverence for God, I did not act like that. Instead, I devoted myself to the work on this wall. All my men were assembled there for the work. We did not acquire any land. Furthermore, 150 Jews and officials ate at my table, as well as those who came to us from the surrounding nations. Each day, one ox, six choice sheep, and some poultry were prepared for me, and every 10 days, an abundant supply of wine of all kinds. In spite of all this, I never demanded the food allotted to the governor, because the demands were heavy on these people. Remember me with favour, my God, for all I have done for these people.
So, confronting the loan sharks and resolving conflicts. It's been said, it's often true, that people pull together in a crisis. That's very often the case, but unfortunately, it's also true that when there is a crisis, there are always going to be some who seek to exploit it to their own advantage. And this isn't new. We find an example of it here in Israel as the work of rebuilding the wall of Jerusalem nears its completion. Each of the chapters we've considered so far has presented us with a different type of problem. Chapter 1 showed us Nehemiah's personal dilemma as he heard from his brother fresh news of Jerusalem's plight and the what his role could possibly be in the reconstruction of the walls of Jerusalem. Chapter 2 revealed the political problem that he faced in going to see his boss, the king, because he was the king's cupbearer. And we saw that that was a highly responsible position in the palace in Susa. Chapter 3 presented us with the administrative and material problems, the logistics of rebuilding the walls, and the lack of support of some of the nobles who were there. Chapter 4 dealt with the physical problem of imminent attacks from the enemies from outside and the psychological problem of discouragement from within. And now we come in chapter 5 to the serious economic and social problems of exploitation and hardship. Nehemiah had to face that problem quickly, compassionately, if the work was to be finished. We saw last time that he didn't have an easy time in trying to rebuild the walls. We may have assumed from chapter 3, when we discover how quickly the program went forward, that everything was easy going. But in fact, when we look through chapters 4 to 6, we discover all this form of opposition that there was from without. And chapter 5 reveals that as well as that, he had to deal with turmoil from within. So, inside turmoil, one commentator on Nehemiah, Vernon McGee, says this: in the history of the church, we've seen that when the devil couldn't destroy the church by persecution, the next thing he did was to join it. In other words, he stirs up trouble inside. And it's sad to say that down through the ages and even in more recent years, there have been many churches, including this one, Grace Fellowship, which have been through the trauma of inner turmoil and splits. Splits are inevitable. For example, when we're committed to sound doctrine, when we're committed to godly standards of behavior, there always have been, there will always be, those who seek to introduce false teaching or evil behavior into the church. And if the church leaders are to remain faithful to their calling and obedient to God, they have to deal with these different issues. Having said that, even if they do follow what the scriptures teach and act in love, there'll always be some who react in a negative way and who leave. No matter what the cause of disunity, we should always work at resolving conflicts in a biblical manner. The Apostle Paul exhorts us, as he did to the church in Ephesus, to make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace. To the Romans, he wrote, "Let us make every effort to do what leads to peace and to mutual edification." Just leaving things as they are is not an option. We must seek peace and pursue it. 1 Peter chapter 3. So, returning to Nehemiah, how did he face the opposition and the disunity? The builders had given themselves wholeheartedly to this monumental task of rebuilding these walls around Jerusalem, leaving aside the noblemen of Tekoa who hadn't wanted to get their hands dirty. All the others had worked their socks off to get this wall built. The task was nearly over. Only the gates remained to be put in place. Huge gates. If you look at chapter 6, verse 1, you can see what it says there. The problem was that for some time, the exhausted workers had been labouring under severe economic difficulties. Many of them had come in from the countryside, from outside, from Mizpah in the north to Tekoa in the southeast and Ben-Zur to the southwest. They'd left their homes, they'd left their families, and as the work was nearing completion, Nehemiah had to order that they remain within the walls to be protected. And finally, the situation became so bad that there was an outcry. As Carol read to us earlier on, people were crying out saying, "This isn't fair," because there were unscrupulous Jews who were exploiting the difficulties of their fellows. The men and their wives raised a great outcry against their fellow Jews, we read in verse 1. They were victims of alarming greed, which resulted in widespread poverty. Several factors contributed to that state of affairs. We've already mentioned the teams of builders who'd been recruited from far away, but they'd had to take a step of faith, leaving their families behind, going and working in Jerusalem for a period of time. And when the breadwinner was absent, what did the others do? Many large families were feeling the pinch. And in normal circumstances, 8 weeks away from work would cause, inevitably, some degree of hardship. But this was being made worse by three things. First of all, there was a famine. Food supplies had become scarce, especially for those who had no land to exploit. And greedy merchants were using this opportunity to inflate the prices of grain. Then there were the taxes. The Persian king's taxes on farmland and vineyards had been increased to meet rising imperial expenditure, and many people found it impossible to meet the burdens. In his book, Persia and the Bible, a commentator, Yamuchi, says this: when Alexander the Great entered Susa, he found 270 tons of coined gold and about 1,200 tons of silver stored up as bullion. And as governor, Nehemiah would have had the responsibility of collecting some of these taxes. So here's this guy who's caught between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, he's seeking to look after these people, and on the other side, he's got his boss, the governor, the king, Artaxerxes, who's raising the taxes, and his responsibility was to collect them. So he was caught on the horns of a dilemma. Some had even gone so far as to subject their sons and daughters to slavery. Now, this was permitted under Old Testament law, but with strict limits in place. Every slave had to regain his or her liberty after 6 years, and debtors were to be released from all financial liability every seventh year. But there were, inevitably, loan sharks. The law of Moses made it clear that interest on loans were not to be charged under certain circumstances. If you lend money to one of my people among you who is needy, do not treat it like a business deal. Charge no interest. Exodus chapter 22. And Ezekiel insisted that exorbitant rates of interest were immoral. In the context of correcting a misinterpretation of the proverb, "The fathers eat sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge," he stated plainly that the person who did what was right and just and who did not charge excessive interest would surely live. Whereas if he had a violent son who did detestable things like lending with lots of interest, then he would die. It was wicked. That's in Ezekiel chapter 18, verses 8 and 9. How was it then that just one century after Ezekiel's prophecy and the return with Zerubbabel, these people were doing it all over again. These Jews were committing the same sin as that which had caused their exile in the first place. This was despicable, as in order to meet the demands of these moneylenders, some had been forced to sell their children back into slavery. Today, to bring it right up to date, how many families are being strangled by these payday loan schemes, where people unadvisedly have gone into these things and find themselves in a trap that they can't get out of? Before looking at Nehemiah's solution, let's look just at, first of all, at one or two fundamental biblical principles which need to be underlined. We don't know how Nehemiah got to know about the situation, but one thing is certain. In the New Testament, we're taught that the first thing that we're to do if we feel that someone has wronged us is to go and see the person concerned to try and sort it out. Nehemiah did hear about it and resolved to do something. But a leader cannot act if he doesn't know anything about what's going on. It's impossible. And far too often, people complain to everyone except to the leader. That's what leads to dissension and to disunity. It's called gossip, and it has absolutely no place in a church. When I was preparing this message during the week, I read of something which took place a few years ago in the United States. An elder's wife asked the pastor if he knew that an elderly member of the congregation was phoning all the people in the church directory. We've mentioned the church directory this morning, but we mustn't use it for this. Phoning all the people listed in the church directory to find out if they approved of the use of guitars in worship. And as the pastor knew nothing about it, he went to see the person concerned. And the first words were, "I suppose you've come to tell me off." To which he replied, "No, I've come to talk to you and explain why we've changed our music style and also to ask you not to stir up gossip and controversy by phoning around." Had it been today, she'd have probably used social media as well. And that, of course, is to be excluded. Clearly, the person concerned was uncomfortable with such a direct approach. But at least the problem was nipped in the bud when the pastor went to say, "You shouldn't be doing this." Talking to people other than leaders who can do something about it simply stirs up trouble. To resolve conflicts biblically, we should go directly to the person concerned and talk things through. So if someone comes to you with a complaint about somebody else, ask them if they've talked to the elders first. And if they haven't, point out that that's where they should start. Now let's come back to Nehemiah and to his reaction. He was in no position to do anything about the famine. And as the governor representing the imperial power in Judea, he would have had to take the necessary measures in order to collect the increased taxes. There was, however, one domain where he could act effectively, and that was with these people who were extorting exorbitant rates of interest, the loan sharks. Having heard of such inhumane behavior, which had pushed these people to the brink, Nehemiah, we read, became very angry. But he remained in control of his emotions. And so his response covers three levels. First of all, his anger. Secondly, his mind, because he thought about what he should do. And finally, his determination to do something about it. First of all, his righteous anger. Some Christians believe that all anger is sinful. And some even go so far as to say, I never get angry. I keep everything under control. I never lose my cool, even when other people can see clearly that they're upset and they are angry. The Bible clearly teaches that most anger is sinful. But in certain circumstances, it's right when it's righteous anger. Jesus was angry with the hardness of heart of the Pharisees, but he didn't sin. It is right for us to become angry about sinful practices such as child abuse, racism, mistreatment of women, other things too. But it would be wrong for us to respond violently to those who perpetrate such things. It is right and proper that we're affected by what goes on and what we see on TV and what we hear on the radio, what we read in the newspapers. I remember my own mother, who was confined to bed for the last 10 years of her life and totally deaf. But she'd learned to lip read, and when she saw something on the television that she disagreed with, especially something to do with politics, and Margaret Thatcher was in government, or the Prime Minister at the time, my mother wrote letters to Margaret Thatcher complaining about this, that, or the other that was going on and that were being allowed to go on because it wasn't in accordance with what is taught in the scriptures. So she was disgusted by what she saw, what she heard, or she didn't hear, but what she understood, and so she did something about it. Righteous anger. Nehemiah's self-control. Before he contended with the ones guilty of exploiting the poor, he consulted with himself. And that's significant. He didn't go off in a rage and give a rocket to these people. He stopped, he cooled off, he prayed, and then he took action. In Proverbs chapter 16, we read, "He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty. He who rules his spirit than he who captures a city." We all, but especially leaders, need to exercise self-control when we do become angry. And then Nehemiah's determination and his application of biblical principles. First of all, he privately consulted these people who were mistreating the poor. We don't know whether it was a single meeting or several meetings, whether he was alone, I guess he was, but he was putting in place the biblical pattern that if your brother sins, go and show him his fault in private. If he listens to you, you have won your brother. If he doesn't listen to you, take one or two more people with you. While Nehemiah didn't have the benefit of Jesus' teaching on this, he seems to have followed that pattern of private confrontation before any public confrontation. Did he succeed? We don't know for sure, but probably not. And so he moved on to public confrontation. Even with the full authority of the imperial court behind him, he knew that he couldn't resolve this issue on his own. There had been this great outcry. We read, some were saying, others were saying, and still others were saying, so it got worse and worse and worse. And the response had to be on the same level as the complaints. So after the private discussion, a public inquiry was called for. No committee, no kicking it out into the long grass and ignoring the problem. It had to be dealt with. Oppressed and oppressors needed to meet in open session so that the first could air their grievances and the others could respond appropriately. Something was being done, and it was being seen to be done. So what did Nehemiah do? First of all, he appealed to their consciences. Verse 8. He accused them of exploiting their Jewish brothers, who at some previous time had already been bought back from the Gentiles because they were slaves, bought back by their fellow countrymen. And now, owing to these unscrupulous practices of these moneylenders, they were being compelled by their fellow countrymen to return to slavery. And he said that's just not right. He appeals to their conscience. Doesn't it worry you that past generosity shown by these people is being overwhelmed and wiped out by what you're doing to them now? Nehemiah insists that they're your brothers. Come on. Surely your conscience should be pricking you in what you're doing. And their reply was eloquent in its simplicity. Silence. The first step had been made, the argument taken to heart, named and shamed, and they had nothing to say. That was the first step. Then he goes on to appeal to their morality. What you are doing is not right. He wasn't simply content to make them feel uncomfortable. He confronted them with their moral obligations. People who want to enjoy the benefits and advantages of community life cannot live for themselves in total indifference to the needs of other people. The Ten Commandments lay down a pattern of behavior in addition to spiritual responsibilities, and Nehemiah appeals to these responsibilities. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of the Lord? He says to them. They knew, at least in theory, that their God was an awesome God. We've sung a little bit about him this morning. They too knew that doctrine shouldn't be divorced from life, that belief and behavior are inseparable. But not only were they guilty of ignoring his commandments, they were also guilty of dishonoring his name. One of the directives they'd been ignoring was that which Nehemiah lays out in verses 10 and 11. Let us stop charging interest, give back to them immediately their fields, vineyards, olive groves, and houses, and also the interest you're charging them, 1% of the money of grain, new wine, and olive oil. This was a direct reference back to Leviticus chapter 25, if you like to look it up afterwards. Their behavior nullified their witness to an unbelieving world. Israel had been entrusted with a unique testimony to the nations. They were to show the nations what their God was like by the way they behaved. And here they were doing just the opposite. We can also quote the example of people today when we read that the Muslim nations claim that Allah is most merciful, and then we see some of the things that are carried on in his name without any sign of mercy. We think, well, how do the two things hang together? But then aren't we guilty of doing exactly the same thing in some of the things that we do and some of our behavior? Nehemiah also appeals to example. I and my brothers and my men are also lending people money and grain. But let the exacting of usury interest stop. He admits to being personally involved in what was happening. But he says that his money, his grain, were loaned totally without interest, and that they should follow his example. And then he appeals to commitment and to accountability in verses 11 to 13. And there they say, we will give it back. We will not demand any more from them. We will do as you say. And what does he do? He gets them to sign on the dotted line. He believed in immediate reaction. He summoned these priests and the nobles, and he went on to get them to enact a public oath-taking ceremony to make sure that they would do as they promised. He knew that human nature is full of good intentions that are never put into practice. How many of us have made New Year's resolutions at the beginning of this year and we've already broken them? We start off with good intentions, and then just after a few weeks, we've forgotten all about the resolutions that we made. Nehemiah performed this act of prophetic symbolism, as lots of the prophets did. So he shook out his robes and said, may you be like this, shaken out, if you don't follow through on what you've said. They needed to be held accountable, so that they remain true to their promises. Nehemiah went on in writing his memoirs. He casts his mind back over the 12 years of his time of governor in order to describe his own lifestyle. Far from being a money-grabbing governor who used his position to line his own pockets, inflating his expense account, so that he could claim for things that he didn't do. He declares that throughout those 12 years, he'd been motivated by two fundamental principles. His reverence for God, because he only did what he found pleasing, what he knew would be pleasing to God. And he compares his attitude to that of previous governors. Those preceding me placed a heavy burden on the people, took 40 shekels of silver from them in addition to the food and the wine. They lorded it over the people. They reaped all what they possibly could. But his reverence for God wasn't something that was just in his private quiet time, in his prayer to God. It worked out in the way that he lived his life. It meant honoring God's name, obeying his word, loving his people. And so he paid for a lot of things out of his own pocket. He didn't even have it use his expense account for the wine, for the food, for the official banquets and things. He paid for it himself. So caviar and champagne, he paid for them. He didn't charge it up to the king. Artaxerxes, and all the rest. And then we read about his selfless generosity. Not only did he refuse to use his position as governor to eat and drink the best food and beverages available, he actually fed his officials and all his visitors, as I said, out of his own pocket. The early church took this to heart. We read in the New Testament that they sold their own possessions, had everything in common, and sought to distribute money to the poor. Paul, in his second letter to the Corinthians, writes that he often went without food. That didn't stop him serving the Lord with gladness. Here, then, we have a man of God, Nehemiah, who was committed to God's work. And for that reason, he didn't acquire any land. Interesting little point in verse 16. Because he must have known that once the walls had been built, the price of land would shoot up. He could have bought the land for a pittance and then sold it on again further down the line once the price had risen and made an enormous profit. But he didn't. He didn't buy any land. We've seen from this chapter and from preceding ones what kind of man he was. He kept his focus on God, on God's work, and so should we. Many of us can rightly say that we're not leaders, but lots of what this passage teaches us applies to us whether we're leaders or not. Those of us who aren't leaders may be thinking, I wish all our leaders were like Nehemiah, doing what they're supposed to do. Those of us who are leaders might be thinking, if only all the people responded to me like these people responded to him. So it applies to all of us. Not all leaders are above reproach, and even Nehemiah had his faults. Not everyone replies or reacts to being confronted by wrongdoing as the people in Jerusalem did on that particular day. Some react with anger, some react with defensiveness, some just leave the church and go somewhere else or drop out of church altogether. But rather than point the finger, let's all seek to put into practice what this passage is saying to us. In preparing this message, I came across somebody else who said that in a church quarrel, Satan remains neutral but supplies ammunition to both sides. And I think that could possibly be true as well. He's always seeking to stir up controversy, stir up animosity, stir up this, stir up that, saying it's not fair, why should this person do this and why should that person do that? He does like to divide God's people, but the Lord wants to unite his people. I mentioned a few minutes ago about our New Year's resolutions. When Nehemiah addressed these leaders and told them that what they were doing was wrong, and when they confessed that, okay, it was wrong, what did he get them to do? He got them to write something down. They publicly made an oath that they would do what they were told, and they wrote it down. And I thought to myself, just for me, but I'll pass it on to you. What about making a pledge with the Lord? Making a pledge with one another? Just this morning, as I was rereading my notes, a thought crossed my mind. In Job chapter 31, verse 1, Job made a covenant with his eyes not to look lustfully at a girl. Now, we're probably not all tempted in the same way as Job was obviously tempted when he made that covenant with his eyes. But we could make a covenant with the Lord about something that is a problem for us. We could write it down. We could share it with somebody else, a trusted brother or sister in the Lord, so that we would be accountable as these people were accountable, as Nehemiah spoke to them. Let's think about that, the practicalities of it, and see what the Lord is saying to us through that. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for this passage in Nehemiah, which is so rich, which has so much to say. We thank you for the way that through him and his actions, you dealt with that problem all those hundreds of years ago. And we pray that as we seek to put those principles, those same principles into practice in Grace Fellowship and in our own lives, that you will speak to us and bless us today. We ask it in your name. Amen.